We're going to start with one slide. And the one slide is this map right here. I handed out the maps, and you can follow along. And so we're only going to take a few minutes here to kind of lay the geography of the situation out as we go through the subject that we're going to cover today. So as you look at this map, it's a map of Jerusalem. And as you look, I think that's the center thing. Well, if you look at your map and you look at off to the left as you're looking straight on at the map, you'll see that it talks about the traditional upper room, and that's the place where Christ and the disciples had the Passover meal. So they ate that Passover meal there, and interestingly, close to where they, and this is a hillside. You can't tell it from the map, but it's a hill, and it's where the rich people live, the people in power, the people with, I pressed the little middle button, and it did not, what's that? Oh, well, this is the key to success. Okay, so there we go. Okay, so right here's Caiaphas's house, and you can see, well, if I can get the thing to go right. So anyway, and then here is, there it is. There's Caiaphas's house. He's the high priest at that time, and this is where they had the meal. And then, I don't know why it doesn't go over there. There it is. So then you have Herod's palace, and this is where Pilate was headquartered. So he lived in, was built by Herod the Great, but it became the palace of whoever was ruling Judea for the Romans. So Pilate was headquartered in this particular place right here. I don't know why that doesn't do it. So anyway, and then you have another palace here, which is where Herod Antipas lived. And when he came up to the feast, this is where he stayed. And these are all very close. So you kind of get you should just look at the words. It seems like they're traveling a long way. Well, they're not. It's just a few hundred yards away. And just so you know, up here is you have these are, you can't tell it, but they're towers. And this is where it's the place where it was most likely that the scourging took place for Jesus Christ. And so you have these places that are all close together. So what happened as far as the Passover at that time, you had Christ and the disciples, I'm going to have to practice with this, eating the meal here. When they got done with the meal, then they left, and they basically went over here, and they went through the temple area. And then they went out of the temple area and across a bridge, crossed the Kidron Valley to the Garden of Gethsemane. So this is where Christ and the disciples went, and then that's where he was captured by the soldiers, and we'll discuss that as we go through. And then they brought Jesus back across the Kidron Valley and up to where they interrogated him and eventually condemned him, and then sent him on to Herod's palace, where and then Herod sent him to Herod Antipas. He came back to Pilate's palace, and then he was ultimately executed. So we're going to look at this in some detail, and hopefully you'll find it profitable. I thought it would be a good review as we get ready for the Passover. And as you look at what took place with Christ at the end of his life, you know, you can see that it's obvious to me and hopefully to you as you look at what's said, Satan is obviously involved here, very involved. And and he's a side figure, really, but he's involved in what's taking place here. And he's anxiously anticipated his opportunity to bruise the heel of Jesus Christ from the time man was created, because his goal is to thwart God's plan. And so he sought to kill Christ at his birth. That wasn't accomplished. So now he's reveling in the opportunity to really pour it on and cause Christ as much grief as he possibly could. So he looked forward to this, and he had been trying to kill Jesus for 3.5 years. Once his ministry began, then you see these references to the authorities, the people in power wanting to capture him, wanting to take him prisoner, and he's eluding them, because there's a timing involved here, and God wants that timing to work out, and he does not want Christ to be taken until it is time. So what's taking place here is in the fullness of time, and that promise that the Christ would come has been accomplished. But just his coming doesn't do anything. He has to make the sacrifice for you and me. So it's time for that to take place. And ultimately, when this plays out, what we're going to look at is the hour has come, Christ said. He knows the hour has come. And he knows what's coming. And he's willing to go through it, but still, he's thinking about what's going to take place. And you know, as far as I'm concerned, if they were going to scourge me, I would not be looking forward to it, because it's going to be terrible. And they're going to put as much effort as possible into it, and Christ knows this. And he knows that he's ultimately going to be crucified. And that's a horrible death for anyone to die. But we can be thankful that Christ was willing to go through this for us. And as you think about the Passover, what took place at the Passover? Christ is eating the Passover with his disciples. He is establishing the symbols of the Passover for all of us: the foot washing, the bread, the wine. And at that Passover service is Judas. And Judas has already made a deal with the powers that be, and then Satan basically takes over Judas to go on and carry this out. And Satan, as I said, is very much involved in this. As it says in John chapter 13, verse 27, "Now after the piece of bread, Satan entered him. Then Jesus said to him, 'What you do, do quickly.'" So he knew that one of his disciples was going to betray him, and that happened to be Judas. So Christ was in great distress when he gets to the Garden of Eden. He knew this was it. This was it. So they go to the garden, or not the Garden of Eden, excuse me, I'm getting my stories mixed up. He went to the Garden of Gethsemane with his disciples, and they had gone there often. So let's pick the story up in Mark chapter 14, verse 33. And we're going to look at different gospels in order to get the full picture of what's happening here. So you don't have to turn. I'll read the scripture, but by your turning, then you can follow along and get this story more fully. Mark chapter 14, verse 33. "He took Peter, James, and John with him and became very troubled and distressed." So these were the disciples he was closest to, and so he's very distressed. "And he said to them, 'My soul is deeply grieved, even to the point of death. Remain here and stay alert.'" So you're my friends. I want you to be with me during this trial. And so stay here and stay alert. Verse 35, "Going a little farther..." What did he do? Did he kneel down? No, it tells us that he threw himself on the ground, because he knew how serious this was and the great emotion he was facing. He threw himself on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour would pass from him. So God is telling his Father, if it's possible, is there another way we can work this out? Do I have to go through this excruciating, painful death? And so Christ is feeling great distress, and the stress is very real. And as I said, he doesn't kneel down. He throws himself on the ground and cries out to God. Verse 36 in Mark 14, verse 36, he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you." So God, you can work this out a different way. You have the might and power to do that. Take this cup away from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. So if there's another way to work this out, I ask, Father, that we can work it out that way. So then, Luke chapter 22, verse 43. So God recognized that Jesus was under great distress. He's there in the flesh, and he knows what's coming. Luke chapter 22, verse 43. Then an angel from heaven appeared to him and strengthened him. The stress was so great that the Father sent an angel to strengthen him. Verse 44, and in his anguish he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground. And this is a natural phenomenon that occurs when somebody is under great distress. It's called hematidrosis, and it's a medical condition where a person literally sweats blood. So Christ was under great distress and is sweating drops of blood out on the ground here. And it's a rare thing, but it does occur in human beings. And as you realize, Christ is in the Garden of Gethsemane, which is an old olive press. And what's happening to Christ? He's being pressed. The pressure has been being placed upon him, and Christ is feeling it. And so he begins to sweat blood as he goes through this emotional upheaval. Luke chapter 22, verse 45. When he got up from prayer, he came to the disciples and found them sleeping, exhausted from grief. So they knew something was up. They knew that Christ was going through great distress. And it's a very difficult time, which we would all feel if we were in the same place. Verse 39, so he found them sleeping, and he tells them, "Hey guys, wake up and wait here with me." And then Mark chapter 14, verse 39, it says he went away again and prayed the same thing. So he went to the Father again, and he asked God if there was another way to work this out. And he said, "Abba, Father, please take this cup away from me." And, he was looking for another way to work this out, if possible. Mark chapter 14, verse 41, talks about the third time that he came to the disciples. So they've been sleeping the first two times. He comes to them again. And what does he find them doing? He finds them sleeping. He says, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Enough of that. The hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up, let us go. Look, my betrayer is approaching." And so Christ is there in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he can look up at the Temple Mount, and he can see the soldiers and Judas and others coming down. He can see the torches, and they're on their way to the Garden of Gethsemane. He can see that they're on their way to arrest him. Let's go now to John chapter 18, verse 2. John chapter 18, verse 2. It says, "Now Judas, the one who betrayed him, knew the place too, because Jesus had met there many times with his disciples. So Judas obtained a squad of soldiers and some officers of the chief priests and Pharisees. They came to the orchard or the wine press with lanterns and torches and weapons." And the soldiers that were coming here were not Roman soldiers. They were the temple guards who served the chief priest and the Pharisees. They were not Roman soldiers. The Roman soldiers don't get involved until we get to Pilate. So these are the temple police that have come out to arrest Christ on behalf of the the high priest, and all of the religious leadership in Judea. So they come out, and they're going to arrest him. John chapter 18, verse 4. Then Jesus, because he knew everything that was going to happen to him, came and asked them, "Who are you looking for?" So he asked them, "Who are you looking for?" And in verse 5, they answer, "Jesus the Nazarene." And he told them, "I am." So he tells them exactly who he is. And it says, "I am he" in the English translation, but it should be translated, "I am." He's telling them, "I am God. I am Yahweh, and we are here." And he tells them exactly who he is. So now that the end has come, then he's much more open about who he is. And so he says, "I am. I am your God." So now Judas, the one who betrayed him, was standing there with them. So when Jesus said to them, "I am," they retreated and fell to the ground. Now we don't know exactly why this took place. It could be some sort of a demonic thing. It could be God causing them to fall back. But whatever it was, he tells them, "I am God." This is not something that would normally be said. But here they are to arrest him, and he just bluntly tells them, "I am." Telling them, I am Yahweh. And they're somewhat astounded by what he says. John chapter 18, verse 7. Then Jesus asked them again, "Who are you looking for?" And they said, "Jesus the Nazarene." And Jesus replied, "I told you that I am. I am. If you were looking for me, let these men go." So his disciples were there, and he said, "You're here to arrest me? Well, go ahead and arrest me and let my disciples go." So Christ was concerned about his disciples even at this particular time. I mean, you would think that his disciples would stand up for him. But once they saw the game was up and that he was going to be arrested, then they folded like a cheap lawn chair and didn't stand up at all. So he said this to fulfill the word he had spoken, "I have lost not a single one of those whom you gave me." So he kept all of them through his whole ministry, but now was the time when they, unfortunately, were going to abandon him. So he knew that, and he knew that his disciples couldn't intervene for him. He was going to have to face this alone. And so the 12 didn't stay with him. They scattered into the night. Matthew chapter 26, verse 48. Matthew chapter 26, verse 48. And, you know, we read what takes place next, and it doesn't really impact us because we're not familiar with the way things were in Christ's time. Matthew chapter 26, verse 48. It says, "Now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, 'The one I kiss is the man, arrest him.'" So this will be the signal to you of the person that you should arrest. Verse 49, "Immediately he went up to Jesus and said, 'Greetings, Rabbi,' and kissed him." And that doesn't seem like a big deal. It doesn't seem like a momentous event. But he said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and kissed him. Jesus said to him, "Friend, do what you are here to do." Then they came and took hold of Jesus and arrested him. And what was taking place here was unbelievable. Here, Judas is addressing Christ as his rabbi, his teacher. And the way society was back then, if your father was taken by somebody and being ransomed, and your rabbi was taken and being ransomed, what did they say? Who should you ransom first? For all of us living in Western society, we would obviously pay the ransom for our father. But in Jewish society, the person who would be ransomed first would be your rabbi, because he was the most important person in your life. And that was the case with the 12 disciples and the case with Judas before he sold him out. And what's unbelievable is not only that he's betraying his rabbi, but he's betraying him with a kiss, a sign of affection. So he comes up and gives him a kiss, a sign of affection. And, you know, as you look at, we didn't look at the seating chart. We will at some time in the future. But if you look at the seating chart, it was a square table around which each of the disciples had a place to lay with their heads toward the table and their feet facing away from the table. And each of them were assigned particular spots. So what was the preeminent spot at the table? The preeminent spot was immediately to Jesus' left. And who was sitting in that spot? Judas was. He gave him the preeminent position at the supper. And yet he's the one who went out and betrayed Christ. He was given the place of honor. And, you know, Christ considered him a friend, but he was anything but a friend. So he betrayed Christ, came out and addressed him as rabbi, gave him a kiss, so they knew this is the man that we should arrest. Matthew chapter 26, verse 51, there it talks about the fact that they had the sword, and Peter had the sword, and Peter chopped off the high priest's servant, Malchus, and Christ, once he had chopped that ear off, Christ said, enough. We don't need any more of that. And he took his ear and put it back, healed it, and put it back on him. But, that had to take place for Scripture to be fulfilled. So let's continue in Mark's account, Mark chapter 14, verse 48. Mark chapter 14, verse 48. Jesus said to them, have you come with swords and clubs to arrest me like you would an outlaw? Day after day I was with you teaching in the temple courts, yet you did not arrest me. But this has happened so that the Scriptures would be fulfilled. Then all the disciples left him and fled. They all left him. They all fled, and all that's taking place here is so the Scriptures could be fulfilled. And yet he was there in the temple. He was there preaching. He wasn't hiding anything, but they didn't arrest him because they feared a riot. You know, Christ had a certain degree of standing with the people of Jerusalem. They knew who he was, and they didn't arrest him because they didn't want to create upheaval. They wanted this to be done as quietly as possible. That's why they're arresting him at night. They're arresting him at night. And you have to realize a certain portion of the people in Jerusalem had already kept the Passover. So they've returned to their homes and they're asleep. Others are looking forward to the Passover on the wrong day, which is the way they kept it. But they're looking forward to that. But there are others who had been there that night, kept the Passover, and they've gone there to their homes, and they're not aware of what's going on here. Now, let's look at the trials. So Christ has been arrested, so now the trials begin. Let's go to John chapter 18, verse 12. John chapter 18, verse 12. It says, then the squad of soldiers with their commanding officer and the officers of the Jewish leaders arrested Jesus and tied him up. They brought him first to Annas, and for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. So why did they take him to Annas? Annas had in the past been the high priest, but Annas was basically the godfather in this scenario. He's like a godfather figure, and he was the real power behind the throne. So they took him to Annas first and brought him there, and that's where Christ was first interrogated. Chapter 18, verse 14. So they brought him to Annas, then they took him on to Caiaphas, and you can see Caiaphas's house on the map there at the top on the left. So Now, it was Caiaphas who had advised the Jewish leaders that it was to their advantage that one man die for the people. And so he basically didn't realize what he was saying, that it was a prophetic statement that one man would die for the people, and that's exactly what happened. It's better that one man die for the people than we all lose our power and lose our authority and all of the wealth-making opportunities that we have. So it's better that Christ die rather than this continue on and eventually the Romans become unhappy and remove us from office. Chapter 18, verse 19. It says, while this was happening, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. Jesus replied, I have spoken publicly to the world. I always taught in the synagogues and the temple courts, where all the Jewish people assembled together. I have said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who heard what I said. They know what I said. So Christ hasn't been hiding anything. He's been preaching and teaching openly, but he's asking him this question, and he said, ask the people that I taught. But as it says in verse 22, they thought, that Christ was struck by one of the high priest's officers because they felt he was being disrespectful. But he was just telling him the truth. And like he says, if I've done something wrong, then you're right. But if I've spoken correctly, why are you striking me? And Christ had done nothing deserving of being stricken in that way. Mark chapter 14, verse 53 says, then they led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and elders and experts in the law, those commonly called scribes, they all came together. So all of these Jewish leaders came together for one purpose, and that was to make sure Christ died. All of these people were in cahoots together, and their goal and their purpose for getting together was to condemn Jesus Christ to death. That's the only reason they're getting together, to be able to find evidence to condemn him. And they're basically on a mission to get rid of Jesus Christ. It's an amazing thing how people can collude together in this way to carry out a murder or carry out something else, and that's exactly what they're doing. Mark chapter 14, verse 54. It says here that, and Peter had followed him from a distance up to the high priest's courtyard. He was sitting with the guards and warming himself by the fire. And the chief priest and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. And they did not find anything. So their goal was to execute him. That was their goal and their purpose. And Peter, we know, followed along. And when some of the people recognized him and confronted him, he denied Jesus Christ. I don't know him. I'm not one of his disciples. Say a low point for him, but thankfully God is merciful. Mark 14, verse 56. Many gave testimony against him, but their testimony did not agree. Some stood up and some gave false testimony against him. We have heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with hands and in 3 days build another not made with hands. Yet even on this point, their testimony did not agree. So they've sought to get people who would be able to give testimony against him, but they couldn't agree, so they couldn't condemn him. Mark chapter 14, verse 60. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus a direct question. Have you no answer? What is this that they are testifying against you? But he was silent and did not answer. Again, the high priest questioned him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? That's a pretty direct question. So he lays that out and expects an answer. And what does Christ say? He said, I am. I am the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One. And he goes on to say, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven. So he's quoting from Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. It's a remez, speaking of the return of Jesus Christ. And he's telling the high priest directly who he is. I am the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One. That is the Son of God. And he said it that way because he didn't want to use God's name directly, because that was considered blasphemy. So he did not blaspheme, and he was careful in his language. They understood exactly what he was saying. Throughout the last week of Jesus's life, Jesus does a number of things that really anger the religious leaders. He calls them God's enemies. He goes through and cleanses the temple, overturning the money changers' tables. In Matthew 23, he lays it on the Pharisees, calling them snakes and hypocrites repeatedly. All of these things were clearly offensive to the religious leaders of the Jews. And they tended to incense those leaders, and they became more and more determined to end his life and get this troublemaker out of the way. Mark chapter 14, verse 63, after he's talked about the fact that he is the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One, and uses the term I am, in verse 63 of Mark, it says, then the high priest tore his clothes and said, why do we still need witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. What is your verdict? And they all condemned him as deserving death. Then some of them spit on him and to blindfold him and strike him with his fist, prophesy. The guards also took him and beat him. So here these people hate him thoroughly. And they've reached the point where they can condemn him, at least by Jewish standards. And they're doing if you've ever been spat upon or slapped, that's exactly what Christ was facing. And this is just part of the thing that he had to go through. Luke chapter 22. Let's go on to Luke chapter 22, verse 66. In Luke 22, it says, when day came, so Christ has been up all night, and Christ has been facing the Jewish leadership, and now it's drawing toward morning. It says, when day came, the council of the elders of the people gathered together, both the chief priests and the experts in the law. And they led Jesus away to their council and said, if you are the Christ, tell us. But he said, if I tell you, you will not believe. And if I ask you, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God. So Christ is just telling them the truth, which, as we well know, they couldn't handle the truth. So Jesus' trial has been going all night. It's morning. And as you look at Psalm chapter 110, verse 1, you have a remez here, which ties in with this and with what Jesus said. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. And he is clearly saying that he is the Lord, that he is Yahweh. And he's telling them straight out that's who he is. And they just find this completely unacceptable. And this just enrages them more. Luke chapter 22, verse 70. Luke chapter 22, verse 70. So they all said, are you the Son of God then? And he answered them, you say that I am. And then they said, why do we need further testimony? We have heard it ourselves from his own lips. He's admitted it. So why do we need to go on? We can condemn him at this point. Matthew 27, verse 3. And when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus had been condemned, He regretted what he had done and returned the silver coins to the chief priest and elders. So he gave them back the coins, the 30 pieces of silver, and they didn't want them. And so Judas just threw them into the temple, and they took them and bought a potter's field, a place where you would bury the poor. And Judas realized what he had done, but it was too late. You'd already taken this drastic, irretrievable action against the Son of God. You've been with him 3.5 years, and you don't realize who he is and the purpose for which he's come into the world, and you're willing to take this action to betray him? That's exactly what he did, and he realized what he was doing, how wrong it was, but it was too late. It was too late. So, and you know what's interesting, as Christ is going through all of this, you notice one thing that they never bring up, a tremendous miracle that had taken place earlier. It's ironic that when Christ was tried before the Sanhedrin, that they never asked about Lazarus being resurrected from the dead. Well, they weren't going to bring that up. They were going to touch that with a 10-foot pole because it was an unmistakable miracle. And they didn't want to bring that up because basically it made Christ's case. And they didn't want to bring that up. In fact, as you look at the story of Lazarus, they thought about killing him too, because he just complicated their situation. So they didn't dare bring up Lazarus. And they wanted to get rid of him. So as Christ comes to the end of his life, he becomes very open about who he is. And the reason is because it is the fullness of time, and because the hour has come, his final hour. Now, let's move forward to Jesus going before Pontius Pilate. And we'll pick up that portion of the story in John chapter 18, verse 28. John chapter 18, verse 28. There it says, "Then they brought Jesus from Caiaphas to the Roman governor's residence." And now it was very early in the morning. So they went to Pontius Pilate and went to his residence, which we've seen here is close to the house of Caiaphas. Christ is staying in Herod's palace, and that's his home during the time of Passover, because he's come up with the troops from down on at Caesarea on the coast, come up with them to keep order in the city. So he's there, and they take Jesus to Pontius Pilate. And it's interesting that these people are so meticulous about right and wrong that they're unwilling to go into Pontius Pilate's house. They're willing to murder Jesus, but they're unwilling to go into Pontius Pilate's house because they don't want to be defiled, because if they're defiled, they can't take the Passover. And you're thinking, maybe their values are a bit askew as you look at they're willing to kill Christ, but they want to be very meticulous about being defiled or ceremonially defiled. And, so it's interesting here. They won't step into the house of a Gentile. So what did Pilate do? He came outside and he asked them in chapter 18 of John, verse 29. "What accusation do you bring against this man?" And they replied, "If this man were not a criminal, we would not have handed him over to you." So, you know, basically they're saying, we wouldn't have brought this man to you if he wasn't guilty of some infraction. So they basically are speaking in a very defiant way here to Pilate. And if you remember, it's important to remember, what did they condemn Christ for? They condemned him for basically saying that he is the Son of God. From a Jewish perspective, this is blasphemy. So they come before Pilate. Now, is that the accusation they're going to make before Pilate? Well, let's see. Luke chapter 23, verse 2. So he asked them, what accusation are they going to make? Luke 23, verse 2. So the religious leaders begin to accuse him, saying, "We found this man subverting our nation, forbidding us to pay the tribute tax to Caesar." He never did that. He paid the tribute tax to Caesar. And claiming that he himself is Christ, a king. So so they don't bring up the issue of blasphemy to Pilate. Why not? Because from a Roman perspective, they didn't care about whether Christ was blaspheming God. That was irrelevant to them. All they cared about was getting the taxes and keeping order in the land. That's all they cared about. So whatever they were doing religiously was fine with them. So Pilate could care less about whether Christ blasphemed the God of the Hebrews or not. And they change their accusation. Now, why did they change their accusation? Because Christ, as I said, Pilate didn't care about whether they were blaspheming God. That was irrelevant to them. But when you get down to issues like sedition and issues like rebellion, all of those kinds of things are serious issues to a Roman governor. And for those particular positions, you could be executed. So they changed their accusations because they want Christ dead. So... they want to make sure that they make an accusation that will stick. That way Pilate will execute Jesus Christ. John chapter 18, verse 31. John chapter 18, verse 31. Judas told them, "Take him yourselves and pass judgment on him according to your own law." The Jewish leaders replied, "We cannot legally put him to death." This happened to fulfill the word spoken Jesus had spoken when he indicated what kind of death he was going to die. Now, if the Jewish leaders executed Christ, how would they execute him? They would execute him by stoning. But that's not how they want him executed. They want him executed by the Romans. And how are the Romans going to execute him? They will crucify him. They will crucify him. And so that was the Roman way of execution, not stoning. John chapter 18, verse 33. So Pilate went back into the governor's residence, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" So he wants to address this question. And as he's questioning Jesus, he's trying to get to the bottom of the matter. And Jesus replied, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or have others told you about me?" And Pilate answered, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own people have, and your chief priest handed you over to me. What have you done?" And you know, as you look at Pilate's approach here, he seems to be trying to get to the bottom of the matter and understand it. And so then Jesus says in John chapter 18, verse 36, he says, Jesus replied, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were from this world, my servants would be fighting to keep me from being handed over to the Jewish authorities. But as it is, my kingdom is not from here." Then Pilate said, "Are you a king?" And Jesus replied, "You say that I am a king. For this reason I was born, and for this reason I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who belongs to the truth listens to my voice." And Pilate asked him, "What is truth?" So Christ is explaining things to them, and he admits that he was born to be a king. So he's not denying that accusation. Matthew chapter 27, verse 12. Matthew 27, verse 12. And while he was being accused by the chief priest and elders, he answered nothing. Then Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" How he answered him, not one word could be translated. He didn't answer any of the accusations that they were making against them. And the governor marveled greatly. And they're accusing Christ. And, you know, who's at work with what's going on with the religious authorities? Who is the accuser of the brethren? It's interesting the way that they're accusing him of one thing after another. Luke chapter 23, verse 5. It says, but they persisted in saying, he incites the people by teaching throughout all Judea. So all of this began in Galilee, and it's gone down through the land, and is now here in Jerusalem. And so they're accusing him and wanting to get rid of him. Now, when Pilate heard this, he heard that, you know, he was from Galilee, then he said, hey, I can get out of this and not have to make a decision. I can send him on over to Herod Antipas and let him kill him. And so he goes over there, and Herod had no problem with killing Jews. Isn't he the one who killed John the Baptist? Absolutely. So he had no problem with killing Jesus. But he questioned him, and Christ didn't answer him at all. And then he returns him to Pilate. And as you look at what takes place here with Antipas questioning him, let's go to Luke chapter 23, verse 8. Luke chapter 23, verse 8. It says, when Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad, for he had long desired to see him, because he had heard about him and was hoping to see him perform some miraculous sign. So he sends him over, and it's about 200 yards from where the palace where Pilate's at, over to the Hasmonean palace where Antipas lives. Or is at during the feast. It's only 200 yards away, so it's a short trip. And he questions Jesus, and he was hoping that he would perform some miracle. He didn't care what Jesus taught or believed. He was looking for a miracle. Verse 9 says, so Herod questioned him at considerable length, and Jesus gave him no answer. And then in Luke chapter 23, verse 10, Luke chapter 23, verse 10. It says, the chief priests and experts in the law were there vehemently accusing him. Again, the accuser of the brethren. Even Herod with his soldiers treated him with contempt and mocked him. Then dressing him in elegant clothes, Herod sent him back to Pilate. And, you know, you see these accusations being made, and you know, Satan is hard at work here. And that very day, Herod and Pilate became friends with each other, for prior to this, they had been enemies. So Jesus' accusers are following along to Herod's palace, where they continue accusing him. Now, one of the things that they did during this time was they would release a prisoner, and so Christ was a prisoner, and there was also a fellow named Barabbas. And Pilate asked him, who do you want me to release? And of course, at the egging on of the religious leadership, they're going to let Barabbas go. And he was a zealot. He was somebody that was dedicated to the overthrow of the Roman government. He was a murderer. Christ had done none of those things. But they were so bound and determined that Christ would die, they said, let Barabbas go and kill Jesus Christ. So they chose Barabbas to be released. And the leaders of the Jews had persuaded the people to accuse Jesus and to let Barabbas go free. Matthew chapter 27, verse 20. Matthew chapter 27, verse 20, it talks about that. And they wanted Barabbas to be let go. And it's interesting that the people that are here crying out for Barabbas to be released and for Christ to be executed, it's a different crowd, as I said. It's not the people that had kept the Passover the night before. It was people who were basically a rent-a-mob. So the leadership of the Jews had probably paid for these folks to show up early in the morning at Herod's house so that they could make sure that Jesus is condemned. So they've paid these people whatever sum it was to show up and to basically advocate for Jesus' death and punishment and a rent-a-mob, and they were reflecting the mindset of the leaders of the Jews. So at this point, then Pilate's going to begin to take action. John chapter 19, verse 1. There it says, Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged severely. And that flogging, as I said, was probably taking place at the three towers. You can see on the left at the top, the three little circles together. Yeah, that's probably where he was flogged. And verse 2 says, the soldiers braided a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they clothed him in a purple robe. And they came up to him again and again and said, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they struck him repeatedly in the face. Again, Pilate went out and said to the Jewish leaders, "Look, I'm bringing him out to you so that you may know that I find no reason for accusation against him." So Pilate couldn't find any reason to condemn him. I mean, he was willing to flog him and flog him severely, but he couldn't find any reason to execute him. So then we come to chapter 19, verse 5. So Jesus came outside wearing the crown of thorns and purple robe, and Pilate said to them, "Look, here is the man." And when the chief priests and their officers saw him, they shouted out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" And Pilate said, "You take him and crucify him. Certainly I find no reason for an accusation against him." And the Jewish leaders replied, "We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die because he claimed to be the Son of God." So these people seem to be, or, you know, claim to be meticulous in the law, and yet they're willing to break their own law to see a man unjustly condemned and crucified. So anyway, Pilate is basically blackmailed or coerced into condemning Jesus. He can't find any reason to do so, but they're threatening him. And basically they said, if you don't condemn him, we will go to Caesar in Rome and make our accusation to him. And Caesar is the one that Pilate was ultimately answerable to. And if he goes before Pilate, Pilate's already been in trouble with Caesar. And this basically intimidates him to do what the Jewish leadership wants him to do. So chapter 19, verse 13. John chapter 19, verse 13. When Peter heard these words, he brought Jesus outside and sat down on the judgment seat in the place called the stone pavement. Now it was the day of preparation for the Passover about noon. Pilate said to the Jewish leaders, "Look, here is your king." And they shouted, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" Pilate asked, "Shall I crucify your king?" And the high priest replied, "We have no king but Caesar." So basically, they want to get rid of him, and Pilate sees no way out. Matthew 27, verse 24. It says, when Pilate saw that he could do nothing, but that instead a riot was starting, he took some water, washed his hands before the crowd, and said, "I am innocent of this man's blood. You take care of it yourselves." In reply, all the people said, "Let his blood be on us and on our children." That's a pretty bold statement by the people there. And then he released Barabbas for them, but after he had Jesus flogged, he handed him over to be crucified. So verse 27, It says, then the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the governor's residence and gathered the whole court cohort there. Cohort's about 500 soldiers. So you have about 500 soldiers. Many of them have been brought down from Caesarea on the coast, and they're all around him. Verse 28, they stripped him and put a scarlet robe around him, and they braided a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand, and kneeling down before him and mocked him. Hail, King of the Jews! They spat on him and took the staff and struck him repeatedly on the head. There is coming a day when these soldiers are going to be facing this one that they've treated so despicably. They don't understand what they're doing. But there's going to be a day when they're going to stand before Jesus Christ. And they're probably going to be sweating bullets at that particular time, worried about what the outcome's going to be. But thankfully, Christ is a merciful God. And Christ will basically tell them, what you did was wrong, but you're not going to be condemned for it. So as you look at this, how despicable the actions are, and you can see that Satan is obviously on duty here. Mark chapter 15, verse 20. When they finished mocking him, they stripped him of the purple cloak and put his own clothes back on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. And the soldiers forced a passerby to carry his cross because Christ was so weakened from the scourging that he couldn't carry that crossbar for his execution. So they brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which is translated place of the skull, and they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it because he was about to be crucified and he was dedicated to following this on through to the end. Chapter 19, verse 18 of John. Then they crucified him along with two others, one on each side, with Jesus in the middle. And Pilate put up a notice there. This is Jesus, the Nazarene, the King of the Jews. The Jews didn't want this sign put up there, but Pilate said, I've done what I've done. I've written what I've written. That's how it's going to be. And they placed Christ on the cross. They put him on the main road to send a message to other people. You don't mess with Rome. And so Christ has been crucified. And it's interesting, he's been placed on the cross in Matthew chapter 27, verse 39. Let's go there. Matthew 27, verse 39. Those who passed by defamed him, shaking their heads and saying, you who can destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are God's son, do you remember where those words were used? Those very words were used as Satan tempted Christ. If you are God's son, do such and such. And those same words are used here, which to me is an indication of who's very much involved in what's happening here. Verse 41 says, in the same way, even the chief priest, together with the experts in the law and elders, were mocking him. He saved others, but he cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. If he comes down from the cross, we will believe him. Do you believe they would have really believed him if he came down from the cross? I don't think so. They wouldn't have done that at all. So then they basically split his garments. Then they had one last garment, the nicest garment that Christ had, and they didn't split it because of the fact that it was a very nice garment, and so they basically cast lots for it. Luke chapter 23, verse 42. Luke chapter 23, verse 42. Then he said, Jesus, remember me, and this is one of the criminals speaking, when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus said to him, I tell you the truth, today you will be with me in paradise. Now, that's been a confusing verse for people, but there's a way that you can explain this very easily. So he said, today I will be with you in paradise. So Christ went on to die shortly thereafter. So did Christ go to heaven or paradise that day? No, he didn't go to heaven that day. He was placed in the tomb. And he was in the tomb for 3 days and three nights. He was not in paradise. He was sleeping in the tomb. And so the idea that this says that he's going to heaven that day is not accurate. He was in the tomb for 3 days and three nights. Now, will that robber or criminal be resurrected one day into a paradise in which Christ will rule? Yes, he will. Yes, he will. But there's just a time lag in there. It'll be about several thousand years beyond this particular point. So then we have, the darkness that came over the land. And, Christ says, my Father, why have you forsaken me? And then verse 27, verse 48, Matthew chapter 27, verse 48. So as Christ says this, my Father, why have you forsaken me? In verse 48, it says, immediately one of them ran and got a sponge, filled it with sour wine, and put it on a stick, and gave it to him to drink. But the rest said, leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah will come to save him. So that's the way it reads in most of the Bibles that we have. But it's interesting if you look at the 20th century New Testament, the next verse. What does it say? It says, however, and so as they're giving him this at the end of his life, we have this man took a lance and pierced his side, and water and blood flowed from it. So this is taking place not as John depicts it later on, like he's already dead and they plunge a spear in. That's not how it happened. The way he died is they plunged a spear into his side. And what does Jesus say? He cried out with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And then you look at what Luke chapter 23, verse 46 says. It says, then Jesus, calling out with a loud voice, said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And after he said this, he breathes his last. And, Christ died by being speared in the side. So you see here the arrest and the execution of Jesus, and it's a grisly affair. It was a very high price that was paid for me and you, a price that none of us deserve. It's interesting what Luke has to say in Acts chapter 2, verse 22. Acts chapter 2, verse 22. Here Peter is speaking and says, men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs which God determined, by signs and wonders in your midst, as you yourselves also know, him being delivered by the determined purpose and foreknowledge of God, you have taken by lawless hands, have crucified and put to death, whom God raised up, having loosed the pains of death, because it was not possible that he should be held by it. Christ died for our sins, and nothing could stop him from being resurrected. And nothing can stop God's plan from unfolding. And the Apostle Paul talks about this. This will be the final scripture. Colossians chapter 1, verse 9. Colossians chapter 1. Verse 9. There it says, for this reason we also, since the day we heard it, do not cease to pray for you and to ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will and all will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding, that you may walk worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing him, being fruitful in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God, strengthened with all might according to his glorious power, for all patience and long-suffering with joy, giving thanks to the Father who has qualified us to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in the light. He has delivered us. This is what all of this terrible ordeal that Christ went through, this is the reason for it. He has delivered us from the power of darkness. Just like with ancient Israel, they became free as God freed them. And through God's might and power, we are free as well. And it says, and conveyed us into the kingdom of the Son of his love, in whom we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins. So all of this that took place with Christ's arrest, his interrogation, and his condemnation and execution, it's an ugly, ugly thing. And it had to be done in order that we could be forgiven of our sins. And that's why we gather together at the Passover this coming Thursday evening to think about what the price that was paid by Jesus Christ for all of us, to be reminded of it and to rejoice in it, and to remember the great price that was paid on our behalf. So as we have the chance this week, take the time to think about the price that was paid for all of us, and think about what price that Jesus went through. And he was willing to do it because he wanted for each and every one of us to potentially be a part of his family forever. As it says in Hebrews, it says that we are his brethren. He's not ashamed to call us brethren, and he was willing to die for us in order that we could stand justly before God and one day be a part of God's very family. So hopefully you'll find that beneficial, give you some things to think about, and I appreciate your attention. And please have the great remainder of the Sabbath, and for those who are going to stick around and help us with the cleaning to get ready for Passover, appreciate everybody who does step up and help out. So please have a great evening, and for those who will be at the Passover, we'll look forward to seeing you then, and look forward to the days of unleavened bread that'll soon be here.